Okay, my name is Marty. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be live and sober. I noticed there were no tissues up here, Scott, so I thought I'd get the crying out of the way right away. my story. I told you I was born. So it was early June 1990. I came to in the wee hours of morning. See, I told you I'd start crying. In a house of questionable repute in East Berlin, and the reason I was there was because I went with a friend to a house in West Berlin, and they kicked him out for not drinking, for drinking too much. And I thought, man, I've never seen anybody got kicked out of a place for drinking too much. And I know it's true because I was standing right next to him. So I came to that morning, and I was just overwhelmed with the feelings that we've all had of shame, of guilt, of incredible, that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I managed to get back to my hotel, and I spent the whole day in the room, you know, in the bed with the covers over my head, and I'd been absolutely defeated. You know, it was soon after that I walked back through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I was young, I grew up in Evanston, as Scott mentioned, and I was going through some stuff to get a luggage tag put on my bag, and I came across a photo of when I was in first grade. And I saw this really happy kid, and I was like, when did that change? You know, I don't know when it changed. At some point in my childhood, you know, I got focused on self. I suffered from that selfishness and self-centeredness, which I didn't know. I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started feeling those emotions of, you know, I just didn't fit in. I didn't get it. I didn't, you know, I didn't understand. And as I grew older, I started to develop the feelings of inadequacy and inferiority. My father was an alcoholic drinker. His side of the family was. This is an interesting part. My mother's side was the Irish Catholic side. There's no alcoholism there. Believe it or not, and my grandfather died at the ripe old age of 99. He lived a life of moderation. He used to have like one can of beer a day, and that was the good example. And then my father's side, which, English and French Canadian, they were the raging alcoholics, and they were. And that's the example. My mother used to say, "Well, you had the example." I said, "Well, I had two examples." And and this is the way I went, and. And, you know, I remember all those emotions we've all had. And then, you know, I guess I was 16. I can't remember exactly when I tasted beer. I hated the taste of alcohol. I couldn't understand why anybody drank it. And I wanted so desperately to be a part of, you know, and I finally kept that. One time I kept that drink down. It was beer, and which became my drink of choice. And I couldn't understand why anybody liked it. And then I finally, you know, kept down that one beer, and that warm and fuzzy feeling came over me, and I was like, now I understand. And then it was, I think I was born alcoholic, but, you know, they talk about crossing that line. And by my senior year in high school, I'd been blackout drinking. As soon as I started drinking, I drank right to blackout. I was like, this stuff's great. I want more. And I also was a great driver. And I like to demonstrate my prowess. And I wrecked two cars. I wrecked my father's car. It was a Cutlass, and it was fast. And it was raining, and my best friend was right seat, and I almost killed him. But I didn't. And 3 weeks later, I wrecked my own car. And, you know, the bottom line is I suffered no consequences from this. So I began to develop the delusion that, you know, I didn't really have a problem. It was bad luck, circumstances, and I can manage this well. So, you know, and I went away to college, and I studied history, and I wanted to be a pilot. And like my father and my brother was just 6'1", you know, Paul Newman, good looks, beautiful guy, naval aviator, Vietnam veteran. And I wanted to follow in his footsteps, and I was short. I wore glasses, and, you know. And, you know, I spent a summer with the Marine Corps, and I was there, and they said, no, Marty, you know, you're not going to be able to fly, but you're going to make a great platoon leader. And it was 1971. I said, I think I'm going to try something else. So I enlisted in the Air Force and basic training. They asked me to volunteer and to be a defensive fire control systems operator. So what is that? And I found out. And a defensive fire control system is a machine gun. So I spent 3 years as a gunner on a B-52, and I had a wonderful time in the Air Force and spent most of my time in Thailand. And I learned that real men drink and party and carry on, or so I thought, because that's who I gravitated to. I didn't want to be around anybody that was normal, because I was not comfortable around them at all. So got back to the university. I went to Southern Illinois, great aviation program, and it's really, I think, where I began this Jekyll and Hyde lifestyle. I began, and my behavior, you know, began to get worse, and my drinking was daily, but I was able to show up and do my thing, and I excelled in the aviation program. It was the first time I did any good in school. I was terrible when I was young. I think I was ADD. I didn't know. They said I was a daydreamer, and I excelled in it, and I did well. But I also did really well at hiding my alcoholism. And, I seemed to go on through my career. You know, I did some corporate flying. I went on, and I was bored. I was uncomfortable. I didn't belong there. I was out in Pittsburgh, and wherever I went, I didn't belong there. And so I went to Africa. Man, did I like Africa. Because I was like, nobody's judging me. Nobody knows me, you know. Yeah, I stood out like a sore thumb, but I was so delusional. But I continued to do well, and I continued to this bottom. I was started to live in a bottom, but I got promotions, and I got this, and I was a chief pilot, and I was a project manager, and then, you know, that ended, and I went and found my first little airline job, and it was a great opportunity. And, I was hired right into the left seat and went off to Berlin to fly these turboprops for a major airline, and my favorite airline of all time, which you'll hear more about. And I'd arrived, this idea of unmanageability was foreign to me. I was managing really well. I had a little drinking problem. And it got worse and worse. When I was in Africa, I'd married a gal. I lived on the island of Malta, and I destroyed her life. And I had a son, and I fought for custody and got custody of him, and I raised him. And losing track here. My ex had passed away. It was very unfortunate. And but I raised this boy, and then. So I was back in Philadelphia, and now I was, I was a Czech airman, as an evaluator, and I was struggling with, still struggling now with the drink, and I'm back home, living with my mom at 37, and, because I have my son, she's saying, okay, no drinking. She knows all about the alcoholism. She knew all about it. I said, okay, no problem. So I started the process of, I wouldn't drink at home. I'm on the road. I'll drink on the road. And then it started sneaking it at home, and then I'm sneaking out and doing it, And I became this despicable, pathetic person. But somehow I didn't know the truth from the false. I buried it in the back of my mind. I remember this time I'm going to take my son to the park. And, I walked downstairs and, I had this like box of wine. I hated wine. She had this box of wine sitting there. And I grab a bottle of wine. So I go down the stairs, and there's a screwdriver stuck in it. It's an old two flat, the back end's all wood. There's a screwdriver stuck in it. I take the screwdriver, because that's how you open a bottle of wine, and push the cork in, no problem. And I'm sitting there at this park drinking this wine with my son in the sandbox. And I'm taking a leak over in this tree. I'm like, and that's what I became, what I hated. Marty, you gotta go back to Berlin. In February, I went to visit an old friend. He was a gunner. We were gunners together. We were in Southeast Asia together. We lived off the base together. Give you an idea, picture. And Jim and I went to college together at Southern, and he became an MD. And he went into medicine. I went aviation. He called me and said, come down and visit me. I'm like, oh, man, he's going to want a party. And last time I saw him, his wife was almost in labor, and we're out shooting pool and drinking. And, you know, before cell phones, his peeper goes off, he picks up the payphone, he calls home, he goes, "Yeah, Becky, what's up?" He says, "How much time between contractions?" "Okay, rack them up, you know." And so that's my drinking buddy, right? So so I go to see him. I'm thinking, how am I going to not drink? How am I going to, you know, I got to tell him. I'm controlling it, just really white-knuckling it. So I sit down, and his apartment, we start talking, and he's not offering me a drink. I look on the table at his little prayer hands. I go, oh, uh-oh. There's a Serenity Prayers on there. And Jim told me a story. He'd been sober, clean and sober, 18 months. Now, he's an MD. You know, his drugs had brought him to his knees, and went to treatment. He'd been through their program. And so, Marty, I think that, you know, you could use Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, yeah, I think so. And that meeting he took, that night, he took me to my first meeting. And it was that kind of meeting we all experienced, you know, in a small church, a small town in Indiana. And, you know, there was people from every walk of life, and they talked about powerlessness and unmanageability. And I knew I'd arrived, you know. And then I for the next 30 days, I was, at the time, I was down in a simulator in Houston. I was instructing and getting check ride stuff in the simulator. And so I was going to a meeting every day, noon meetings, da-da-da. And, but, you know, a few things I didn't do that were suggested. I didn't get a sponsor because, you know, I manage pretty well by myself. I got this under control. I just got a little drinking problem. And so I didn't work the steps. And I disagreed with some of them. And I didn't read that book. Somebody gave me the book. I didn't read the book. So basically, I didn't do anything. I went to meetings, and 30 days, I got a 30-day chip at the west side of Houston, the gallery or something. There's a big meeting there, if anybody's familiar. And I went there, and I got a 30-day chip. I'd stand in the back, you know, walk up. I didn't know anybody. And I got my 30-day chip in my bag. That night, we're out of the simulator with two of my normie buddies, and we're walking back to the hotel by the cockpit bar and grill, owned by two pilots. And so I'll stop and have a beer, and I'm like, oh, my God. They're going to find out I'm sober. What are they going to think of me? So I go in there with them, and I'm standing there, and next thing I know, there's a bottle of beer in my hand. And, you know, I drink three bottles of beer. And I go back to the hotel, and I sleep like a baby. And I wake up, and I'm thinking, I'm cured. This is beautiful, you know? I know how much money's in my wallet, and, you know where's my car's parked. I'd be like, this is great. So I don't spare you the details. Fast forward 2.5 months, I'm waking up, I'm in this hotel in Berlin, and I'm defeated. Absolutely crushed. And I get back to Chicago, I go to a meeting in Evanston that morning, Sunday morning, and I can't tell you that I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous had the answer. I can't tell you that I had planned it all out or knew what to do. I didn't know. Something, you know, I got that intuitive thought. There's something going on here. And that's when I was introduced to my first higher power, which I will call the gift of desperation. And I walked in this meeting, and it was a big, huge room like this, and there's this breakfast buffet. There was a breakfast menu, and there was nobody there. There was this one little table with this gal and these two other guys. And this gal and these two big black guys, right? And so I sit down over there, and I'm like, geez, there's nobody here. But being a pilot, I'm on time, so right when it starts. So she comes over to me, and she goes, hey, how you doing? Fine. Would you like to join us? No, I'm okay, right here. So she sits down. I'm like, oh, boy. So, you know, she starts talking to me. And it comes out, you know. And so I move over and sit down with them. I start talking to these two guys. And I had worked for the city. And I, you know, after 5 minutes, we're talking about mutual friends, people we work together with. And again, I'm introduced to similarities and not differences, you know. And there was a speaker meeting. I think they had three speakers. It was kind of like this. Different groups would come into town. And they were... I don't remember anything they said. You know, I remember then after it, Rachel takes me across the street to a coffee shop. We talk some more, have some coffee. She calls Paul, who became my first sponsor. And I started this journey, you know, and I started reading the book. I started going to meetings with him. He was a retired banker from Wall Street, believe it or not. And and he lived like three blocks from me. So I had no excuses, you know, and we started working the steps. And somewhere along, the obsession was lifted. I think that day I walked into that room, and I have not had a desire to drink since then. And you back up to that February, that when I picked up that drink, it was early March, and there's a friend who was arrested on March 8th, and it was all over the paper in the news, and it was just terrible. And you'd think that that would be enough for me to say, oh, my God, I can't pick up a drink. You know, I wasn't, you know, the farthest thing from mine. I'm an alcoholic. I have lost a choice. I have absolutely lost the choice on whether I can drink or not. And so there I am, and now June 7th was that's my sobriety date, and so I start this journey. And then I'm 4.5 months sober, and this woman walks into my meeting and smiles at me. She has no idea the effect that has on me, so... She's doing it again right now. You know, and, you know, 2 weeks later, I take her out to dinner. So, and we dated for a year, and we ended up getting married. And, you know, our sponsors knew each other. You know, we talked a lot about this, and it worked out okay. We up and left and headed to Phoenix. The part I left out was the company had gone out of business, and 4 days before our wedding. And, you know, I got a little bit of money in the bank. She had a little debt. She calls it a wash. And, remember, I had kept my profession. I'd kept my job. I had money in the bank. I had a car. I thought it was impressive. It was a Plymouth Horizon that ran on three cylinders. You know, when I read in the 12, I think it was in the 12 and 12, where it says about the bottom, and it says, you know, about the two cars in the garage, and I go, that's me. But it's my mother's garage. You know, and one of the cars is hers, and I'm driving this Plymouth Horizon. I take Claudia to dinner, right? I said, oh, come with me. She says, pie, it's probably got a Mercedes, you know. She comes up in this Plymouth Horizon. I said, it looks pretty good, just waxed it, you know. So we're... I'm very fortunate that 4 months after Pan Am goes out of business, this little Texas airline hires me, and I go to Phoenix. And I was extremely fortunate. And it was there that, we got to start to see a fellowship grow up around us. And I knew right away, I get down there, and I'm feeling the old feelings. I'm different. You know, they do it weird. They're AA here. It's kind of odd and different, and I'm not a part of, and I'm different from these people, and... You know, and I know right away what I have to do. I've got to find a meeting I really like, and I got to find somebody there, and I got to have some sponsor me. And that's what we did. And we jumped right into Alcoholics Anonymous in Phoenix. And we were there 10 years, and we watched this fellowship grow up around us. And I slowly kind of grew in the steps, but not really well. And because I'm still under the delusion I'm managing well. We got huge egos. And, you know, the ego has to be smashed. And I've learned that. It has to be smashed over and over again. Because I have this, you know, it's like those old fuel tanks in there, and fighters in World War II, they had these rubber tanks. The bullets would go through them, and they'd seal themselves, right? And that's my ego. Gets punched, seals itself, reinflates. And it does it on a daily basis. So it's got to be smashed all the time, you know? I went through a period there where, you know, I got really angry because I was stuffing everything inside. I stuffed it down inside and I left it there. And then something would push the button and out it would come. It wouldn't matter who's pushing the button. Out would come whatever's inside. And then somebody I was real close to said, I'd like you to go talk to somebody about your anger. And I said, okay. And that seemed to be, it turned out to be a really good thing. And then I came, you know, and in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that the answer's there. But, you know, in this particular case, I needed some outside help. And What I've learned is that the steps are the answer for me. The spiritual principles are the step for me. And then I moved on. We moved on to Phoenix. My wife got a PhD, and went up to Sacramento. And still, I haven't really sponsored anybody yet, okay? We moved to Sacramento. At this point, I forget, it was 2012. I don't know how long I was sober then. But, I'd say nobody wants what I have, except the IRS, And so my wife's, sponsoring like 30, 40 women. And so I get up to Sacramento, and I get a new sponsor. And he recognizes some things right away. I remember having problems, and he's like, so why don't you apply step three to this problem? I'm like, okay. He's like, you have worked step three, right? I'm like, well, so we started the process again. I mean, I realized that I hadn't thoroughly worked the steps, and I got what I was, I had invested in it, and I was getting a little nuts. And I'd gotten involved in the HIMSS program. I was active. I went to HIMSS conferences. I was working with guys. I was monitoring guys. I ended up the chair for a while of the HIMSS committee. I was, but I still had this part of me that was under the delusion that I'm different. My case is different. And I'm managing just fine. And we know what that means. And again, I made that, I had that little epiphany, and I thank God for good sponsorship and telling me what I don't want to hear. And I could continue to progress again. And I'm going to a men's meeting that's my home group, and next thing I know, I'm sponsoring 11 men. And they enrich my life, I've completely turned my will and my life over now to a power that I can't explain to you. I can't tell you what it is. But I'm at peace. I finally find that peace, and I'm so grateful for it. Because that's all I ever really wanted, was just a little peace of mind. And now that's where I get my relief. But I know that just going to meetings is not going to keep me sober and sane. I didn't have any idea I had a living problem, and what I found here is a design for living that I didn't have. I had no idea. My parents did the best they could. They didn't know. They did the best they could. And I'm so grateful today. Birds of a Feather was a huge impact on me because I got together with a group of guys that I could really identify with. And it's not elitist. It's not that I think I'm different in that case, but it allowed me. I knew my foundation was in Alcoholics Anonymous, it allowed me to go out and be a better member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and plus to have this wonderful fellowship with men I love and women who are aviators, and we have these meetings and we get together and we get to talk about similar stuff, because I was in such incredible fear over they're going to find out, And there's people here that really know exactly what I'm talking about, and they know me very well. And my fear was lifted quite a while ago. But I have to be. I'm in a Birds of a Feather conference in 2007, and it was 97. It was 97, and down in Phoenix, and I'm sitting at a table with Bart Packel, who's a head psychiatrist, and. Dr. Lynn is here. He knows. He was part of this. And Garrett O'Connor. All the pilots were scared to death of Garrett O'Connor. He's a psychiatrist from L.A. Because he was sober a long time and you couldn't BS him. That's what I learned. He's a great guy. And I was sitting at the table with these guys, and I'm thinking, they're going to find out I'm sober. I'm in a Birds of a Feather conference. The only pilots there are alcoholics. They're going to find out I'm sober. And then Scott says, hey, I got a 7-year chip here. And I come up to the podium, and I'm crying. And it was a wonderful experience. And there's several men in here that were there that night. It's just this fear has been lifted. And what a burden it is, And it's just the fear is gone, and I have this incredible life. And I still have my career. And although it's waning, I'm looking forward to retirement, and so is my sponsor. My sponsor is a past trustee, and he had told me quite clearly, you're going to have lots of time for general service. So, I have a sponsor, I have a home group, I have a service commitment, and general service is on the horizon for me. So thank you so much for listening. And I've just tried to warm you guys up for the real speakers that are coming. So thank you.
That's great, Marty. Thank you very much. They tell you when you're going to be a moderator, they say if you want to say something in between the speakers, you can. Well, I can't tell you my story, but I can tell you I saw a great T-shirt once at a Birds of a Feather conference, and the T-shirt said, "Mama, when I grow up, I want to be an airline pilot." And on the back it says, "Make up your mind, son. You can't do both." All right. Our next speaker, our second speaker, is another worldwide experience pilot who started out as a flight instructor. She went on to fly cargo in the United States and Canada, and she's flown throughout Africa, even flown in Afghanistan, where she did contract work. She's currently flying a corporate jet in corporate aviation, a Gulfstream, I believe. I'm sure she'll tell you about it. She's been sober since October of 2004, and I'd like you to welcome Nichelle W.
Good morning, I'm Nichelle. I'm an alcoholic. My heart hasn't been beating this hard since I was coming in on final in Kandahar at night with a crosswind, landing on the taxiway because there was an unexploded IED on the runway. But I'll tell you more about that. My sobriety date is October 4th, 2004. However, that was not the first time I darkened the doors of AA. And before I jump into this, I just want to say a happy belated birthday to Canada and a happy early birthday to the United States and a special 80th birthday to Alcoholics Anonymous. So, yeah. Those two countries and NA have been a big part of my story. So I'm a proud Canadian, and I grew up in the Toronto area. And you know, my parents, my dad's side of the family, if the alcoholism or addiction doesn't kill us, the cancer will. And my mom's side of the family is just too angry to die. So that's what I grew up. And I was told in AA that at 5 years, you get your marbles back. And at 10 years, you learn how to use them. So when I hit 5 years sober, I went through a major kind of emotional mental change and sought some outside help and really got into some trauma, causes and conditions and looking at forgiveness and compassion. And I learned at that point that everyone is doing the best they can at their level of awareness. And I have a wonderful relationship with my family today, and that is a direct result of working this program. However, my childhood was very lonely, very chaotic, and a lot of anger, and it was a difficult childhood, and at 16 years old, I decided to leave. Now, in an interesting twist of irony, this is my higher power's sense of humor. When I was 16, I bought a ticket from Toronto to Vancouver to run away, and the company that I bought the ticket with, 20 years later, I started flying a Gulfstream. I never mentioned that on the interview, but that's my higher power sense of humor. So I took off out west, and, you know, my story includes self-destruction in ways other than just alcohol. And the best way that I can explain it is I just moved seats around on the Titanic. So it is part of my story. However, when I was out west at 16, that's when I discovered alcohol and drugs, and the next couple of years were very dark times for me. I had a belief that there's predator and there's prey in life, and there was no way I would ever be prey, and that's a cold and hard way to live a life as a young woman. And you know, things got bad very quickly, and at 18 years of age, I hit a bottom, and I went into treatment. I hadn't spoken to my family for a year and a half. And I showed up to tell them that I had an alcohol and drug problem and I needed treatment. So at 18 years old, I went into treatment and I was first introduced to AA in the 12 steps. And I actually got kicked out of that treatment center for not being totally honest. And You know, it was interesting because at that time I did stay sober for almost a year. And I was going to meetings and I went back to school and I actually did fairly well. And, you know, started to get some peace and serenity. However, I wasn't attending meetings. I wasn't working with my sponsor. And pretty soon I just thought, you know, I'm young. I didn't really have a problem. I got in with the wrong crowd. And I just need to get a career and, you know, just get going. And I made a decision to go back out, but I would just stay away from the hard drugs. So from there on in, I drank like a fish and smoked like a chimney. So for the next 4 years, I started my flight training. And when I started flying 17 years ago, we were 3% women. We're up to 5% now. And so being able to drink with the boys was a handy skill to have. And, you know, when I think back on all of my flight training, and I also throughout all my flight training and my early instructing years, I worked in the bar and restaurant industry. And being a bartender is a great place to be a functioning alcoholic. And, so I made it through my flight training, got all my commercial and multi-instrument rating, and then I went and got my instructor rating. And I taught flying, and 9/11 happened and brought the whole industry to a grinding halt. So I ended up instructing and bartending for a long time. And I think back on those days, and, you know, my poor students, I would show up reeking of booze and cigarettes and angry, you know, and teaching these poor people how to fly in these tiny little airplanes. And, I'm just so angry because I was caught in that cycle of the craving. And, you know, because I'd had that background, every now and then my conscience would kick in, and I'm drinking too much. And I always had an excuse. You know, that was the thing. Oh, it's because of this. It's because of that. And then it finally got to the point. I remember one day I was driving to work, and I had a potent feeling that I hope I never forget, that I was a slave, you know, to my alcoholism. I was not truly alive. I felt dead inside. And, you know, I tried over those few years when I was back out, when it talks about more in alcoholism, okay, no liquor, just beer and wine. You know, I tried every combination. And at one point I went 2.5 weeks without drinking. It was the longest 2.5 weeks of my life. And, you know, I tried it all. And because I had that background from when I was a teenager, you know, my bottom, it was a week before my 24th birthday, and I couldn't look myself in the mirror. I hated who I had become. And I couldn't put it into words until I came in the program and it talked about a spiritual bankruptcy. And for me, I ran out of excuses. And for me, the alcohol stopped working. And I was sick of the lies. I was a blackout drinker. I was a puker. I was a liar. I was a thief. And, you know, the double life killed me. I can't believe how I used to live. It was complete and utter insanity. So my bottom was literally, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and it stopped working for me. And so I had vowed I was never coming back to AA or any 12-step program, but there was nowhere else to go. I tried everything else, you know, and so I came back to AA, and I was living in the Hamilton, Ontario area, teaching flying at the time, and I came back in, and so the journey began. And, you know, in those beginning days, I have a fondness for the grandfatherly types in AA because those gentlemen were the guys who'd come up to me after a meeting and I'd be outside chain smoking. And, you know, they'd walk up like, hey, kid, you got a sponsor yet? You know, or, hey, kid, you know what SOBER stands for? Son of a bitch, everything's real, you know? Hey, kid, you got a sponsor yet? You know, and I was led and I got a sponsor and I got into the steps. And I also got into service and a home group. And at that time, I was instructing, so I could get to meetings almost every night, which was very important in the beginning. And initially, once I had a few months, I got involved with PICBC and was going into the young offenders' homes, which was fantastic because the only difference between them and me was that they'd got caught. So it began. So then as time went on in sobriety, and my sobriety has been very much a process of waking up, and my dreams started surfacing again. And, you know, when I was drinking, I'd always wanted to travel. I always wanted to live this nonconformist life, and I didn't do anything. And I'm super proud of my sobriety. And the second thing I'm most proud of is when I came into AA, I've been to 3 countries. Now I've been to 54, and I'm so proud that I get to travel so much. And So I got a job flying cargo across Canada and the U.S., and at this time I came across Birds of a Feather and the Toronto Nest. And these guys were super helpful, and like Marty said, it's not an elitist thing. It's just there's certain lifestyle questions, certain, and there's the shared kind of experience of not only our love for aviation, but our love for recovery. And, you know, so I started flying throughout Canada and the U.S., and I'd hit meetings everywhere I went, which was fantastic. And I still love that to this day. I love going to meetings all over the world. Wherever I go, I'm home. So, you know, then I had the opportunity to spend 3 summers up in northern Canada, Ontario and Saskatchewan, and I was working in forest fire suppression support flying, which was an awesome job, and met some great people in the north and got to meetings and campouts, and then in the winter I would travel. And one winter I had the opportunity to get a job flying survey over in Gabon, Central Africa. And it was a wonderful experience. I was flying a Cessna Caravan 300 feet above ground, and we would fly and be looking at elephants and wildebeests. You know, when I went over, I took my step work, I took my literature, and kept in touch with my sponsor. And it was a beautiful experience, and I fell in love with Africa. I fell in love with the lifestyle of overseas flying. And so I took a job flying the best airplane in the world. It's a Dash 8. And I was fortunate enough to fly that airplane for 7 years. And the company that I worked for, I spent 5 years flying for the United Nations throughout Africa. And throughout those 5 years, I was based in Uganda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ivory Coast, Sudan, and South Sudan, 4 months of which I was in Darfur. And then 2 years based out of Kandahar, Afghanistan. And I was very fortunate career-wise. I was upgraded to captain after 1 year, and I became a training captain and a line check captain. And I very much enjoyed that. And so on my time off while I was overseas, I would travel. And while I was abroad, I would do online meetings. And I would take my grapevine, my literature, and whenever I was traveling on my time off, I'd hit meetings. And whenever I was back in Canada and the U.S., lots of meetings. And AA New York always knew where I was. I'd email them and say, okay, I'm in Sudan now, I'm in Congo now, and if anyone gets in touch, let them know. And then when I went to Afghanistan, we had 3 meetings a week, the Sober and the Sand group. And the people there, military and civilian, saved my life. And so then a year and a half ago, I left Afghanistan. And 7 years in the world's conflict zones took a toll on my psyche. And I took some time off, and I'm very fortunate that I get to spend time in a little paradise place called Venice, Florida. And I did 90 and 90 coming back. And I was 9 years sober, but I needed the 90 and 90 to get back into Western society. And then last summer I moved back to Canada, and I've been flying a Gulfstream in corporate aviation throughout North America since then. So that's kind of chronologically my story. And what I wanted to talk a little bit about this morning as well is I'm a complicated woman, and I love to complicate stuff. And so in AA, what has helped me is, you know, as Dr. Bob said in one of his final talks, you know, trust God, clean house, help others. So I wanted to tell a little bit about my part in those three things. So trusting God. When I came in, I had a lot of baggage when it came to religion, God, and spirituality. I was raised with a fearful fire and brimstone God. And when I was 16 and I left home, I threw it all away. However, I was always curious. And, you know, in my travels, I always found religion fascinating from a historical and psychological perspective. And I could talk a good talk, but it never made sense to me personally. So I knew when I came into AA, I had to keep it simple. You know, I had to resign from the debating society, because I was that person in the bar who was debating religion and politics. That was me. And I knew that I had to let go of my baggage and my biases. And, you know, for me, God, in the beginning, and in all honesty, it still does stand for a group of drunks. I do get a lot of wisdom and strength from the principals and the people in AA. And you know what I love about it, too, is that my AA angels are always the toughest, roughest-looking character in the room who will say something that just clicks for me, you know. And my spiritual journey, I knew I just had to keep an open mind and stay willing. And you told me to ask for help in the morning and say thank you at night. And I still do that. I've added a few different things that kind of work for me. But I've learned to come to respect everyone's spiritual beliefs. You know, there's over 7 billion people on the planet, and there's probably over 7 billion definitions of spirituality, you know. And I've had a really fascinating journey in my travels when it comes to some spiritual moments. I was fortunate to hike the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu. You know, flying gives a really cool perspective, especially over some beautiful jungles and mountain ranges. And, you know, I get to spend a lot of time at the beach and in the forest. I get a lot of spiritual nourishment from both those places. And, you know, I know for me, so much is in my head. Because I've been in Darfur, I've been in Afghanistan, all these crazy places, and I've been peaceful and serene. And yet, I can be walking the beach, it's a beautiful, perfect day, and I'm angry and obsessing. You know, so I know it's what's going on up here. So my spiritual journey is kind of an ever-evolving entity, and as long as I just stay open-minded and willing and respectful and listening for what my higher power's will is for me, then I'll be all right. Cleaning house. I've had some beautiful experiences. My first fourth step was 32 pages long. And, you know, it was an amazing experience after I had shared the fifth step. And after I'd shared it with the other human, I went down to a lake where I used to lifeguard. And I sat and you know, shared it with my higher power. And then I had some little papers, and I burned my fears and my resentments and misconduct. And it was amazing because when I stood up, I literally felt like I'd lost 50 pounds off my shoulders. You know, that was a great moment of freedom. And I've gone through the steps multiple times over the years. And it was funny because my latest fourth step I did this past October, and I was laughing because I was so quick to just, okay, what's my part in it? You know, I just want to get to my part so I can stop making the same mistakes. You know, where my first fourth step, it was like, my part? You know, and, you know, another aspect, when I worked the ninth step, it took me 2.5 years to make all my ninth step amends. I had a long list. And also, so much of it was timing, you know, and a lot of prayer and discussion when it came, because now it's not just my feelings. Now I'm dealing with other humans. And, you know, I had some pretty interesting experiences with my nine-step amends, because I was making a lot of them while I was overseas. And so calling someone from the Congo and explaining to them why I'm calling them from Congo was a good segue into making an amend and showing that I was not the same person that I used to be. You know, and I need to keep my affairs in order, you know, and if I'm praying for too many people, it's time to do another inventory, you know, and you guys get that. So, yeah, helping others. Service has been a big part of my journey, but of course, with this awesome nonconformist lifestyle that I've had to discuss with my sponsor other ways to be of service, you know. So like I mentioned earlier, AA New York knew where I was, and it was really cool actually. When I was in Sudan, I did have a woman get in touch with me. She was an RCMP officer, and she was in the south and I was in the north, and we'd have phone meetings, and that was really cool. Online meetings, I would share some of those. I would take grapevines with me everywhere and leave them in random places. So if you were in a hotel room in Ethiopia or someplace and you found a grapevine, it was probably me. And you know, and sharing. And, you know, when we were in Afghanistan, it was my job to get our medallions engraved. And so I would go to the German PX with the design, and I got my 8 and 9 year medallion there. So there's very few people in the world who have those medallions. And now that I'm back in Canada, if I'm in town on a Thursday or Sunday, there's a women's detox and treatment center that that I participate in, nothing quite like detox, keep it real, you know, and that's counterbalanced perfectly. I joined my old home group up there, which is an 11-step meeting and lots of long-term contented sobriety. And, you know, Birds of a Feather has been a big part of my journey as well, that, you know, I'm able to go to different nests. I train in Dallas now, and I get to go to the nest there, and because, like I said, I'm fortunate to spend time in Florida. I go to the Fort Lauderdale nest, and we do Skype meetings. And I would Skype in with them when I was in Afghanistan, and sometimes now if I'm on the road, I'll Skype in with them. So, you know, we're never truly alone, you know. And when I came into AA, I was told as long as we're spiritually fit, we can do anything. And I'm so fortunate that, you know, so many of my dreams have come true. You know, I've been very fortunate. Money, property, prestige, career success, adventures, travel, you know, and I am so grateful for all of those things. And I remember when I came into AA, so I was 24, and asking at a meeting, what do you guys do for fun, you know? And because I hung out at bars, that's what I did. And, you know, today my life is, you know, I've gone surfing in Panama and whitewater rafting in Uganda and skydiving in Canada. And, you know, I get to live this adventurous, vagabond, free-spirited, beautiful life. And that same insanity that drove me with my alcoholism, that drives me today. And, you know, all these external blessings and gifts I am so grateful for. But the biggest change is what's happened inside for me. You know, that woman who could barely look herself in the mirror and just hated who I had become. I'm a free woman today. You know, I get to have peace and serenity, and I get to wake up, and I get to learn lessons, and I get to be there for other people. You know, I love that AA says love and tolerance is our code. You know, and for me, every day I pray for love, compassion, tolerance, and forgiveness. That's my spiritual path, and that's probably going to take me a long time to try and apply all of those principles to my life, you know, because sometimes I don't want to be loving, you know, I don't want to be forgiving. And, you know, it's amazing today that I'm part of a WE program, because I need that accountability, you know, because I'll come up with brilliant ideas, but then I need my sponsor or a trusted loved one to go, do you think maybe that self will run riot or your spiritual path, you know? And I need that accountability. And, you know, sometimes we're the teacher, sometimes we're the student. And I'm so fortunate that, you know, I get to pick my 2 years up in Costa Rica. You know, I get to go to all these amazing meetings throughout the world. And, you know, I've seen a lot of ugliness in this world, and I've also seen a lot of beauty. You know, and I was grateful to see it all sober. It's all real. I'm there for it, you know. I'm an active participant in my own life now, as beautiful or as painful as that may be. And, you know, I am so, so grateful to be part of something. And I'm so glad that you guys are all here this morning. So thanks for letting me share.
Looks like we're playing a little musical chairs here. Hope they come back. Great story, Nichelle. Thank you very much. I wish I could have done the 1/16th of the things she's done in her lifetime. The three men up here, our wives are in the audience, and it reminds me of a T-shirt that my wife has that some of the wives might appreciate if you're pilots' wives. And the T-shirt says on it, if you think being a pilot is tough, try being a pilot's wife. Throw in the alcohol, and it's doubly. This next gentleman, a highly respected man in my life. He grew up in Boston and joined the Marine Corps. We will not hold that against him. And he graduated from fighter pilot school, completed over 75 combat missions in Vietnam. After leaving the Marine Corps, he joined a major airline in 1966, and he flew for them, and eventually the airline that absorbed them. And you notice I don't say the airlines. I let the speakers talk about the airlines if they want to. And then he retired at age 60, when back in the day we all had to retire mandatory at age 60. It's now age 65, by the way, in case you're interested. He also was involved in the Airline HIMSS program. at both of the airlines he worked for, and this gentleman has been sober since January of 1972. Please welcome Tom D.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tom. Oh, nice full room. I love it. This is going to be an unusual talk for me because normally I got sober in the Boston area, and you may not hear my accent, but and the majority of the meetings were speaker meetings. So as soon as I had 3 months, I was out speaking, you know, once a week. We'd go to somebody else's group, put on their meeting. They'd come in and put our meeting on. So, and right from the get-go, I stayed away from the airline business in my speech. I didn't want anybody to know that I was a pilot. In fact, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I said to myself, if anybody finds out what my last name is or what I do for a living, I'm out of here. I'm not staying. I'm not going to lose my job over this whim, you know, being an AA. So I've always said, you know, I say something like, I travel for a living. You know, I was over in Saudi Arabia, or I was here or there, you know. And one time I tried saying that I was at the time flying 747s. I said, I operate an 18-wheeler. It's got 18 wheels, you know. And, of course, some guy come up to me afterwards, and he said, what are you driving, a Peterbilt? And I thought, oh, geez, I'm trapped, you know. It's one of those lies you get into, you know. But nobody's talked about the hair-raising stuff, you know, the, like, pilot. What is that that latest movie, Denzel Washington? Is it Upside Down, you know, Saving the Day? And that's pretty rare. Also, I can tell you that the 727 doesn't have a sump, oil sump, that will allow the engines to run when the plane's inverted. So, but it was a good story, and I liked watching it, and it made me very nervous because, you know, some of those feelings, I'm too old to be involved in drugs, you know, but it wasn't the culture when I got sober. But, you know, just the feelings he had, you know, going to work and then trying to get up for it and be, you know, right on top of his game. It's very interesting. I suppose I should start at the beginning. I think I was around, just turned 12 years old. My dad had died the year before. He was hospitalized from when I was a small child. With multiple sclerosis, and he died in the hospital. I never saw my dad on his feet. So my mother moved in back with her family of origin, with three maiden aunts, and a bachelor uncle, and my grandfather, Adolf. Well, I didn't call him that to his face, but he's a fine German gentleman who was a very cranky man. But you know, I didn't have a father, but boy, did I have a lot of love, you know, those three ladies. I was the child they never had. So I grew up in that family, and at 12 years old, this uncle of mine, he was a grouch. He was a bachelor, and he was a grouch. But on the weekends, he would drink, and he'd get a quart of whiskey or something and a beer, and he'd sit in a chair, and he'd drink Boilermakers, and then he'd get excited and happy, and he'd tell jokes, he'd sing, and I thought, wow, well, that must be what he's drinking is doing that, you know. So it was curiosity, and I picked up my first drink. It was a bottle of whiskey, and shared it with a buddy of mine, and wow, you know. Non-alcoholics don't get that, you know. It's just, that was the most exciting thing that had happened to me in my life at that time, and I thought, boy. And I suppose I got a little sick or something from it, but I was just flying around that night. It was great, and I said, I'm going to do this again, and I did, and at that age, I couldn't, it was difficult to get hold of alcohol, so who knows how often I did take a drink, but, you know, I became I went to college, and believe it or not, and I drank weekends. I became a weekend drinker. I drank on I drank on Friday nights and I dated on Saturday nights. And sometimes I drank a little when I dated, but that wasn't my interest. My interest was the drinking on Friday night and the ladies on Saturday night. And that took me right through college and then into the Marine Corps, into the flight program, and down to Pensacola, Florida. And then I felt like the pressure was off, no restrictions, and I got into my first little bit of trouble. I had a DUI down there. I wasn't allowed to drive on a military base. I was also restricted to quarters for like a month. I could go to class, the flight line, chow and chapel, and that was it. So I used to have long dinners, and I was not allowed to go in the officers' club. And I remember walking down to the flight line for a training flight one day, and it was raining out, and I was getting wet walking, and a Navy enlisted man picked me up, and he said, "You need a ride?" And I said, "Yeah, I appreciate that." You know, and he said, "What's the matter, Lieutenant? How come you're walking?" And I said, "My Jaguar's being tuned up." You know? I didn't have a Jaguar. You know, it was an embarrassment. So I couldn't drive on a military base for 2 years. You know, in fact, when I got transferred to Texas, I had to sneak off the base in my Volvo and drive over to Texas where I could drive, and that was the beginning. And I got married in advanced fighter training. Went up to Schenectady, New York, and married Doreen, my lovely wife, who's with me today. 53 years later, she should get the applause for sure. We got married, and I said, "You know, I've got to tell you about this. What I do here in advanced training, you know." And I was hot. I was flying an airplane with an afterburner. It went supersonic. We were doing 40,000-foot shooting on targets up, the aerial targets at 40,000 feet, and then we're dogfighting, and, oh, God, you guys. If you haven't done it, sorry, it might be too late. But what a life. But I told her, I said, "Friday night's a sacrosanct. We don't do anything on Friday nights because I go to happy hour." She didn't understand till the second week, when she asked if she could invite some friends over for dinner on Friday night. And I said, "Yes, after happy hour." And she did. And I never came home. I didn't come home, and they went home, and she found me out. I was hanging off a lemon tree in the front yard, and I had lost my Volvo. And she got in the car with a buddy of mine who eventually ended up being a 7-year POW in Hanoi. And the two of them went and found my Volvo at some country western place way out in the woods. And she said, "I want to go home." She said, "I don't think I want to be married. I want to go home." And I said, "I'm not giving you any money to get out of here." But I thought, I went to the local priest in church, and I said, "I want to take the pledge." I heard about the pledge. And he talked to me for a little bit, and he said, "I'm not going to give you the pledge," he said, "because you'll probably break it. You're too young to do it." And he said, I don't know what he said to me, but, you know, he might have been an alky. He might have been a recovering alky. He spoke to me. So I went home and continued on my way. But I had sporadic stuff that happened like that. We've got enough pilots in here. I can tell a story. Took off one day in a F-11F afterburner. Saturday morning, surprise. I got back to the quarters that night and found out that I was scheduled for a Saturday morning flight. I thought I had Saturday off, and I was at happy hour. I think I drank a little bit too much. I took off. I went down the runway, and you take off an afterburner because it didn't operate too well in basic engine, and you need to get that afterburner in there and pull back and rotate, and the first thing you do, you pull your gear up, landing gear up, flaps up, climb to 10,000 feet, take it out of afterburner, climb to 40, to 20,000, put it back in and go to 40. And anyway, I took off in afterburner. And instead of raising the landing gear, I raised the flaps. And that gives you lift. And now I'm going over the Texas landscape, and I'm not climbing. And I got the gear down. Now, in about 8 seconds, I'm going to blow the gear right off the airplane because I'm picking up speed, you know. So what I do is take it out of afterburner. And now I got no flaps and no afterburner, and the gear's still down. And I see a barn coming up in front of me. Oh, my God. You know, I could have that could have been it. I wouldn't have been here today, you know. But, you know, I got the gear up, and I got the afterburner back in and got up. And I went up, and I didn't go to 40,000 feet. I went to 20,000 feet, and I went out over the Gulf of Mexico, and I just did little circles till I was running low on fuel and came back and landed. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm never going to do that again. I never did. I never did. I never raised the flaps first. It's a learning process. As Scott said, you know, I ended up in Vietnam. Japan first and then Vietnam. And I have to tell you, in Japan, there was a lot of drinking, a lot of drink. I was flying single seat, single engine, A4 Skyhawks. And we were doing a lot of on-the-edge stuff, you know, flying as fast as it'd go, slow as it'd go, high, low. You know, we're getting ready to go in country into Vietnam. And part of the squadron had left. As they were building this expeditionary base in Vietnam, Chu Lai, they were bringing airplanes in. Those of us who weren't heroes, the lieutenants, all the junior guys got left behind. And I get drinking on Christmas Day. I had drunk before that, of course. But on Christmas Day, everybody's walking around with a long face because they're home. They're there without their families, and, you know, all the wives and kids are home. And so I thought, I'm going to liven this up. So I went in town and bought a big plastic tub, and we filled it up with alcohol. Anything anybody had, we put in there. You know, it was wine in there, it was whiskey, it was gin, and fruit, a lot of fruit. Make it healthy. And we drank that stuff, and I started drinking that day, Christmas Day, and I drank every day until about early April when we were taken out, you know, went and left for Vietnam. But I kept promising myself, tonight I'm not going to get drunk tonight. I'm not going to drink tonight. I'm going to eat. I'm going to have a good meal tonight. And I go into the officer's mess, and to the right was the bar, and the left was the dining room. And I go in, and every night I'd say, I'm going to have one. I'll have a beer. Next thing I know, I'm drinking beer with the guys, and the chow line stops. They stop serving food, and I didn't eat again. And next morning, I'm sick, and then I got to fly. And lunchtime, I go over to the club, get something to eat. And I have a strawberry shake, a bowl of tomato soup. That's all I can hold down. And promise myself I'm not going to drink that night. So finally, I couldn't figure out. I had a hallucination. I was in bed, and I saw a little red devil playing a piano. It was like a hologram. It was, you know, up in the around in my room. And my buddy came in, and he said, what are you doing? And I said, I see this thing up here, and it's a little red devil. And I said, do you see it? And he said, no. He said, you got like the DTs or something. And I said, oh. And that was it. Oh. You know? I thought, I got to stop drinking. I can't. I couldn't figure out how to stop drinking. So I came up with a plan, and I went to see the flight surgeon. I said, I want you to take my appendix out. He said, you having pain or what? I didn't even know where the appendix was, you know? I said, no, not really. And he said, why do you want it out? And I said, well, it's a useless organ. And we got time on our hands. Well, why don't you take it out? And I'll never have appendicitis if you take it out. He said, get out of here. I'm not taking your appendix out. The plan was that I would be put in the hospital and I wouldn't be able to drink, and I would break the cycle. And that's the way, that was my best thinking. That's how I was going to break this drinking cycle, you know, and stop the daily or the nightly drinking. And well, God had other plans, you know, and the bell rang, and they were ready for us down in Chulai. And I flew down to Chulai and arrived there, and I thought, well, you know, I wasn't in very good shape when I left for Chulai either, I'll tell you that. I'd spent all my extra yen in town the night before, and I was in kind of bad shape. But by the time I got to Chulai, it was hot. It was April. It was 100 degrees, and the runway temperatures were operating off short runways with JATO takeoffs and arrested landings, and there was no officers' club, and there was no booze. The only ones that had booze were the old sergeants, the old NCOs. They thought enough. They packed up booze for it, and there wasn't any. And I got sober. I got sober. That was my detox. And you know, after a few days, I was really feeling good, and I knew why I felt good, because I wasn't drinking. And so I had a nice period of, you know, flying missions and, you know, clear eyes, clear head and all that. And a Navy ship came in and offloaded a load of booze, and we drank it down in about, Lyle knows, we drank that booze down in about 2 days. It was gone, and then we were dry again. So it was a pretty healthy, actually, for a war, it was pretty healthy for me down there, I'll tell you that. Yeah. I survived that, and after I got back from there, I got a job in Boston in production, in management at Gillette, and I was doing production forecasting and analysis, and I was going crazy. I was hyped. I was still hyped up from coming right from back from Vietnam. I was I don't think I had PTSD, but everything was boring to me. Finally, Doreen said to me, "You know, you're a real bear," she said. "You really need to go fly. You need to be in an airplane. Either go down to local airport and instruct, or go back in the Marines, or go with the airlines." But she said, "You should be flying airplanes." And she was right. She was right. And I went down and got a job with the airlines. And you know, and then I spent my career flying. I can tell you because I'm out of business, but I went with Pan Am. And they had a base in Hong Kong. And we went to Hong Kong. I had 2 great years in Hong Kong. She will not agree with me because but they were real fun for me. But I was peaking. I was getting to that point again, you know. And then I got back to the States, and I was with the same airline out of New York, and I became a control drinker. You know, no, I can't. I don't know. I can't tell you any horror stories. You know, it was an awful way to be. You know, to have that thirst, as the Irish call it. You know, and be trying to control it. And you know, we had 12 hours from bottle of throttle. You know, and I'd be watching the watch. You know, go out to have something to eat, go and get some Schweinshaxen in Frankfurt. You know, and a couple of beers. And got 11 minutes. You know. Get one more in, you know, and stuff like that, and you know, it was hard. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I said to myself, "I'm going to mess up. I am going to show up one of these days. I'm going to be so hungover, or I'm still going to be drunk, you know, and I am going to get fired, and you know, that'll be the end of my career." So I did most of my drinking at home in between trips, and I flew internationally. You know, I flew a lot of the places she flew, and you know, all over the world. It was wonderful. But you know, I'd get home and I'd do my drinking at home. And in the middle of the week, I had nobody to play with. All the guys were working, and they didn't want to go out drinking until weekends. And so anyway, I would grace my family with my drinking. And so it was Christmas time, 1971, January 1972. And I had come in, I think, a couple days after Christmas. Typical. I wasn't home for Christmas. I was in Africa someplace. And I got home a couple days after Christmas, and we celebrated it then. And then And then New Year's came, and I had a good period of time off, and New Year's buddy came down, and we got good and drunk. And then I got drunk every night till the 7th. And every morning I was sick. And I was, you know, here I'm going again. You know, and I didn't have to go to work for a while. And on the 7th of January, I woke up on a couch in the family room. And my wife, I always tell this, my wife was standing over me with my son, who was 8 years old. And she woke me up and she said, "Your son wants to know why you don't sleep in bed anymore. Why do you sleep with your clothes on? And why do you smell so bad?" And, you know, all I could think of, you know, I looked up at them and I said, "It's none of his business. I'll do what I want to do. You know, I put the roof over your head and the food in your mouth. And this, you know, I'll do what I want here." But, you know, that wouldn't get a lot of people sober. But, boy, that was the straw that broke the camel's back for me. And if I were to tell you one word that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, was disgust. I was disgusted with myself, not just for that incident, but for a lot of stuff, and for broken promises, and you know, not being able to handle myself, and not being able to control my booze. And I knew that I was getting drunk even when I didn't want to. I was surprising myself sometimes by coming home drunk, you know, and I didn't like that. So I called a lot of guys now, a lot of pilots, they get captured, you know, they throw the net over them and they go to rehab and people turn them in or they turn themselves in. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous, asked for help, and a lady said to me on the phone, "I understand how you..." I said, "I'm 32 years old and I'm all screwed up. Can you please help me?" And boy, that was hard to say. I had this Adam's apple. I think it grew to the size of a tennis ball. You know, I could hardly swallow. And she said, "I understand how you feel." And I said, "How do you understand how I feel?" And she said, "I'm an alcoholic. I know how you feel." And, you know, that little thing gave me hope. Maybe she knows. Maybe she knows how to do something about this, you know. And a guy came and took me to my first meeting. And, you know, I've been coming to meetings ever since then. He was Neil Sullivan, God bless his soul, you know. He made sure that I got to a meeting every night that I was home. And then he ordered me, when I go on my first trip, to get to meetings. And he didn't give me any instructions how to do that. But I was smart enough to find meetings wherever I went. And I was flying a lot of Europe at that time. And every city I went to, I found meetings. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came home, and then I started speaking, and I was on a pink cloud. I was happy. And when I was in rooms at night, meetings were from 8:30 till 10. And when I was in a meeting, I just, the air would come out of me. I just sit in the seat, you know, and listen, and I felt safe. This was a very safe place. And when I left the room, I didn't feel too safe. You know, I didn't feel safe in the street. I just... You know, I was almost felt like my old self again, but I look forward to those meetings every night. And I got a one-year cake from the group. I was the first pigeon, and we call them pigeons back there, not sponsees. I'll call them sponsees here for everybody else. I got a cake, and I thought, this is corny, you know. I want a cake. And I got up, and I after the meeting, and they presented me with the cake, and congratulations, everybody clap, you know. It's a year sober, and I was the first pigeon in the group to get, the first pigeon in the group, period. And then I said, I'd like to thank my sponsor, and Dr. Bob, Bill Wilson, and the Pope, and the President, and Jesus. Yes. Oh, well, anyway, it was right as sometime shortly after I got that cake that my wife said to me, "You know what? I liked you better when you were drinking." Oh, today I know why she said that, because I hadn't gotten into the steps. I was a year without a drink in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was at meetings every night, but I hadn't touched the steps. No, I told my sponsor, I'm gonna give her a demonstration what it used to be like. And he said, no, He said, I got a better idea. So we started a step meeting around his dining room table at night, he and his wife and I, and I started learning about the steps, and I had to start learning about me and find out what my character defects are and find out what I had to change and what I had to keep and make amends to people and take care of business, you know. Look at my life. Look honestly at my life. And you know, I started doing that, and pretty soon I was looking at the dining, at the kitchen table. That's where we ate, and I had three kids. We had three kids, excuse me, and it sit at the table, and I was always one of these. I could reach them from where I sat. You know, if they spilt the milk, they were gonna feel the hand of God on them. You know, but I noticed that we were having dinners at night and chit chatting about what they did in school, and we were having peaceful meals. And I thought, oh my God, it's working. I'm bringing the program home. Because I was 12-stepping people from like third month. I don't know how many 12-step calls I made, you know, with because of lack of not detoxes, but rehabs. There weren't rehabs back in 72, not many. So we were doing a lot of 12-step work. But I wasn't bringing it home. I finally realized that I had to bring this thing home. And my life started to improve, and my family's life certainly started to improve. Along came HIMSS, Human Innovation, Human Intervention and Motivation Study. That's a mouthful. That's the FAA and the pilot group and the airlines got together, put this thing together to save pilots. Remember I said if anybody found out what I did for a living, I was going to scram because I would have got fired. If I was labeled an alcoholic, they would have fired me. There was no recourse. The union wouldn't defend me. But now this program that they built was to save some pretty nice guys like me. These people, you know, save us and keep us. You know, we're a valuable asset to the company, really, you know, without alcohol. So that started. And also the Birds of a Feather. What does that mean? Okay. He wants me to wrap it up here. I've only got about 20 more minutes to go. I want to tell you that life has been very good for me, but I want to clarify something about Birds of a Feather. Birds of a Feather, it's like a specialty meeting. It's for pilots. It would have been great for me when I snuck in, you know, to AA, because I was terrified that somebody was going to find out that I was an alcoholic. What we try to do with guys is guys will come in, and a lot of times the rehabs will send them, you know, make sure you go to Birds of a Feather. We have this camaraderie, and what we try to do is get these people to, that's only one meeting a week. We want these people to get out in the mainstream, especially the private pilots, you know, that have diagnosed themselves and asked for help. So we make it comfortable for them in there, you know, they know that nobody's going to squeal on them, you know, and get them into mainstream AA, and we watch over them. You know, we're like sponsorship. It's like a whole bunch of sponsors taking care of them, and it's turned out to be great. You know, we don't talk about how you get your license back, or we don't talk about flying at the meetings. We talk about AA. It's just an AA meeting, you know. But afterwards, we'll go out and have something to eat, or beforehand, and we'll say, you know, how's it coming? Did you get your medical certificate back? Or, you know, did you see the psychiatrist? Did this or that? You know. But the meetings are strictly AA meetings, and I love being with my guys. We tell some wicked lies. Oh yeah. So, and I've been privileged to speak here today. I always am, and I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to be asked to come up here and share my experience, strength, and hope. And God bless you all. Thank you.